Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday, October 3rd. It is 10 o'clock, and this is Jeff Dunphy coming to you from Calgary, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. We're going to chat a little about the slow-moving train wreck that is the state of affairs on the planet today, but first I want to share with you a brilliant picture. It is a picture of umpteen little African children looking like they're in between 4 and 5 and 8 or 9. And an anthropologist had proposed a game to these kids in an African tribe. He put a basket full of fruit near a treat and told them that whoever got there first won the sweet fruits. When he gave them the signal to run, they all took each other's hands and ran together, then sat in a circle, enjoying their treats. When he asked them why they chose to run as a group, when they could have had more fruit individually, one child spoke up and said, "Ubuntu. How can one of us be happy if all the other ones are sad?" Ubuntu in the Xhosa culture means "I am because we are." This is a very profound aspect of that which we propagate on this show, and that is, as go we, so go I. And it is a wonderful reminder that we are all on this planet as one species. And boy, we're going through a bunch of a mess that would divide us. What's the phrase? United we stand, divided we fall. This is an unbelievably unfortunate act of divisiveness that's going on right now on the planet. The founding fathers of the U.S., as opposed to Canada, because the founding fathers of Canada was the British Empire, the founding fathers of the U.S. organized it in such a fashion where it could promote and embrace and hold democracy, where the benefit to the all outweighed the benefit to the few. And it was also organized in a place where, even though they had civil war, and they were pursuing freedom, if you will. And so at one time, the U.S. was a free democracy. However, when did it end? So as we've spoken of over the past several years, you know, we would say that the end started about 100 years ago with the creation of the Federal Reserve, okay? But in fact, I think it was in November of 1910, while this group of the Western world's wealthiest and most powerful oligarchs, mostly bankers, met in secret on a private island on the coast of Georgia. This island, believe it or not, was called Jekyll Island. There was great secrecy around them. They were told not to call each other by their first or by their last names when the servants around them could hear. They wanted to make sure that they all had fishing rods or guns or whatever. They were going on a sporting event. They were going fishing or shooting or whatever, when many of them didn't even own a gun. And at that secret meeting, they plotted the creation of what we now know as the Federal Reserve. Now, there was a guy named Edward Griffin, G. Edward Griffin, and he wrote a book called The Secret of Jekyll Island. The Creature of Jekyll Island, my apologies, that's what it was called, The Creature of Jekyll Island. And he basically talks about how the Fed is a legislated banking cartel, sort of a hybrid between a government agency and a private corporation. And when it wishes to invoke the authority of government in order to command obedience for its decrees, it cloaks itself in the guise of being a part of that government. And I will tell you this, the news and the news that be and the game that is played on everybody, we all think of the Federal Reserve as a government aspect, a government tentacle, if you will. And at all other times, it behaves purely as the privately owned corporation that it is, acting solely in the self-interests of the handful of the oligarchs who own or control it. So the Federal Reserve is the ultimate wolf in sheep's clothing. And thus, the irony of the choice of location where the Federal Reserve was effectively created. Jekyll Island, go figure, right? So the actual legislation which institutionalized this banking was done in 1913. Proof that it came into legislation with no resistance whatsoever comes when it was signed into law on the 23rd of December, when most of the U.S. government was away on holidays, okay? So how and why did the creation of the Fed, the Federal Reserve, signal the beginning of the end of the U.S. endless... It's because the Fed was legislated as an entity above the government of the U.S., and thus above any of its laws. And any who think this odd, you may want to listen to Sir Alan Greenspan explain what the independence of the Fed really means. That the Federal Reserve was and is the supreme authority within the U.S. Obviously, no nation whose government is subordinate to a private cabal of ultra-wealthy individuals can be possibly characterized as democratic. The government elected by the people should be the government that is answerable to the people. So what was it that these bankers did, and what was it that they considered it necessary to seize effective control of the U.S. government in this brilliantly devised, bloodless, unofficial coup? They did it to gain absolute power, economic, fiscal, legislative, to successfully implement their own monstrous agenda, which had been articulated 20 years prior in a book called The Banker's Manifesto of 1892. And I'm quoting from this now. Capital, the wealth of the oligarchs, must protect itself in every possible manner through combination, conspiracy, and legislation. The courts must be called to our aid, debts must be collected, bonds and mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When, through the process of law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and easily governed through the influence of the strong arm of government applied to a central power of imperial wealth under the control of the leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. Okay. This was actually written by a bunch of bankers. So obviously, the plots by these guys to transform the U.S. into sort of a central power to these 1% was particularly ambitious and evil in all senses of the word, and thus required enormous power to bring it to fruition. However, at this point, it may be a bit confusing as to how the creation of the Fed could be a linchpin of such an agenda. I want to add here that 100 years ago, you spent $1 to buy a basket of goods. That same basket of goods today costs you $100. They have, in the course of 100 years, stolen secretly, invisibly, 99% of the purchasing power. So let's put into perspective what the Fed is. Okay, it sort of has an absolute legislative monopoly to create and manage the money supply of the U.S. Now, given that the U.S. money supply is the world reserve currency, it sort of owns the fiscal direction of the world. Now, the U.S. at this point in time is the world's largest economy, and it has the reserve currency status since the end of the Second World War. So it gained absolute control over the money supply of the planet when it became the global reserve currency. Most transactions on the planet of any consequence are transacted in U.S. dollars. So what's the deal? What's the big deal? Who cares? The U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. How does it affect us, and why should I care? So let's go to somebody in the late 17, early 1800s, who was one of the Rothschilds, and his name was Meyer Amschel, and he was quoted as, "Give me control over a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws." So what do you mean? Basically, any group who owns or controls the printing press of any nation can not only create as much of that currency as desired, but they also possess the power to ensure that all that newly created currency ends up in their own pockets. So when you control the printing presses, you have access to infinite amounts of currency. And that's effectively infinite wealth because you create it out of thin air since Nixon and the Bretton Woods Agreement, since he decoupled the U.S. dollar from the gold. So these guys control the money supply. They can simply buy off as many members of the government as is required to control it, and then take their political agenda and legislate anything they want. How can that be, we say? My goodness. It's unfortunate. The creature of Jekyll Island. Since gaining this control, over the U.S. via a bank, which is above the U.S., and that's above the law, they've sought to consolidate this power and do it secretly. This scheme, devised to wield such power while still keeping that power disguised, is what has been referred to by many as kind of a two-party dictatorship. So both of the U.S.'s political parties have long ago since been bought off, as we've seen in various places, by the financial institutions and their lobbying groups, by the banking cabal. Okay, the modus operandi employed to hide this power was to create a perennial, surreal puppet show in Washington. These two political parties appearing to be mortal enemies and saying, you're wrong, and you're wrong, and you're wrong. And we go back to another quote by the Banker's Manifesto that was written in 1892. History repeats itself in regular cycles. This truth is well known among our principal men who are engaged in forming an imperialism of the world. While they are doing this, the people must be kept in a state of political antagonism. By thus dividing the voters, we can get them to expend their energies fighting over questions of no importance to us, except as teachers to the common herd. Thus, by discreet action, we can secure all that has been so generously planned and successfully accomplished. But mere absolute control over the government of the U.S. was not enough for these guys. It wanted to transform that government into a police state. So because, as stated in the manifesto, after robbing the people of their wealth and their land, they required a strong arm of government to maintain control over the common herd and thus preserve the wealth that they had actually stolen. Now, interestingly, this is greed run amok. So, and surprisingly, this last goal of their agenda, to create a police state, is unfolding right now. It's just starting to degrade, and it's starting to experience what's called the law of acceleration. They are starting to do more and more relative to what's happening because they do see that this ship is sinking. So not surprisingly, concealing from the common people that the democracy no longer exists was relatively simple. You've got apathetic people tending not to notice the disappearance of some once familiar facet of their lives. And this, we go back to the Constitution of the United States, is written on but a page or two of paper. And the rules governing the U.S. people are written on hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pages. What a scary thought to think that the government rules the people rather than the government works for the people. Keep the two powers fighting over things that don't concern the bankers. So now it's quite another kettle of fish, however, to impose a police state upon the masses. And this is being done right now, absolutely being done right now, because what is in the throes of transpiring is the U.S. is getting to a place where they're terrified that the people are going to wake up, and as a result of waking up, revolt. So their very iron fist of a police state isn't possible to hide. At best, it can be disguised through all kinds of euphemisms and or, when necessary, simple lies. But at least at some level, the inhabitants of a police state know that they are living in a police state. What finally provided these oligarchs with the pretext to impose this police state, for which they had longed for more than a century, was one of the oldest and most successful tools possessed by old money, the false flag attack. Make everybody frightened, get them into that fight or flight mode, tell them that you will take care of them, make them easy to control. Indeed, going back more than a century, nearly every major war which the U.S. was in or started has been preceded by a very convenient, incredibly coincidental attack of some sort against the U.S. Anyone who doubts the veracity of that statement need merely listen to all kinds of things on the internet. There's a video that I recently watched called The Geopolitics of World War III. And getting the U.S. government to attack itself or manipulate some other entity into launching an attack, they go on to expose, is called as American as apple pie. Now, on September 11th, 2001, now infamously known as 9/11, the U.S. government engineered the ultimate false flag event. Now, this is reasonably controversial, but I would suggest that anybody who wants to go and visit some of the YouTube documentary on this stuff, having been a professor in the engineering department, I do get and understand that engineers are incredibly clever and incredibly resolute in their building of stuff, and I suspect that their capacity to build a tower that could be run into by an aircraft and not designed to collapse is silly, okay? Officially, the World Trade Center Twin Towers collapsed straight down all the way to their very foundations after being hit in the side near the very top by a pair of passenger airliners. This propaganda fantasy has largely survived intact. Now, a couple of things to note. No other steel-reinforced structure in global engineering history has ever collapsed all the way down to the foundations from fire alone. Steel and concrete buildings, obviously, cannot burn to the ground. Nor could heat created up near the 100th floor of the Twin Towers have caused the slightest structural damage to any of the steel and concrete of the lower 54 floors. So as an elementary principle of physics, it's also impossible to collapse any tall vertical structure straight down by any other means than a controlled demolition, which can only occur through explosions which begin at or near the ground level. And then we have the independent forensic experts discovering that the residue of extremely powerful military slot style demolition stuff and that could only have existed in that rubble as the byproduct of an explosion, a controlled demolition. And the Twin Towers, interestingly enough, had been engineered to survive the impact of a plane. However, with the entire mainstream media owned by a tiny handful of corporate entities, who are an integral part of the 1%, to this day only a small fragment of our population have been exposed to these and many other important facts which absolutely disprove the official propaganda. From 9/11 came this never-ending war on terror. And from the war on terror comes the even more egregious and horrific Patriot Act. And we could rename or we could relabel this Patriot Act as the blueprint for a police state. The ultimate evolution of a police state is into a country that participates in what many others have called martial law. So let's wander through a couple of reviews. So they create, 100 years ago, a quasi-government entity called the Federal Reserve, which is above the government and thus beyond the reach of any of its laws. They hand the Fed exclusive control over the printing presses and they can create as much currency as they want and transfer it predominantly to themselves. And with this endless, infinite amount of money, they buy off as many political representatives as they can in perpetuity. There was an article, a writer for the New York Times wrote a book, and in fact, I cannot remember the name of the book at the moment, but effectively he said, over the last 20 years, with the demise of democracy, people moved to Washington not to be of service to their country, but in order to get rich. Because it is through the get rich scheme where they go into government and then participate in the please buy me off down the road. And this in and of itself is horrific. However, it is nonetheless real. So then let's go back to the Banker's Manifesto of 1892. So in order to hide this effective dictatorship, they get their political stooges to stage theater. You notice the U.S. has only two political parties, and they're enemies rather than teammates, and they serve the bankers. And we go back to the quote, by thus dividing the voters, we can get them to expend their energies fighting over questions of no importance to us. So now we get these guys transforming this nonsense into effectively a fascist police state. And this is where everybody's terrified and creating this thing of the bad guys out there are about to get you. And then they create the Patriot Act. Did you know that the U.S. government right now is building more prisons than it is schools? This is a frighteningly blatant compromise of the well-being of the planet. So they explicitly say this is to fight terror. However, outside of the spotlight of the corporate media, most of the actual efforts of the U.S. government has been devoting to creating and or supporting terrorist groups and terrorist regimes. I mean, there's a part where Hillary Clinton many years ago is saying, you realize that all of these Al-Qaeda guys, we were supporting in trying to destabilize Afghanistan when the Russians went into Afghanistan. And many say it destroyed the Russian economy because they had to spend so much money fighting in Afghanistan. So there's far too much empirical evidence of the U.S.-sponsored terrorism to engage in any comprehensive discussion. The only starting point for such a narrative might begin with the godfather of modern terrorism, and that's the State of Israel. Israel became a state in the late 40s as a result of the World War. So let's give you a little history. Following World War II, the state of Palestine, which is the home of the Palestinians, was a British colony. And through a relentless campaign of ethnic cleansing and executions by Jewish terrorists, primarily directed against innocent Palestinians, the British government was persuaded to withdraw from Palestine. However, before departing, the British carved out a large chunk of the state of Palestine and handed it to the Israelis. The leader of the Jewish terrorists, the Israelis, became Israel's first prime minister. Far from renouncing its terrorist heritage, the government of Israel, even to this day, openly boasts about its past, characterizing its serial slaughter of innocents as necessary acts. Now, this is an evolution of stuff that is hardly kept in the light of day merely because the press is suppressing what really is happening. So let me wander through some other things. Here's an interesting observation. When it wishes to violate the Palestinians in larger number, it turns its army loose upon this civilian population. And it depicts these heinous war crimes as anti-terrorism operations or retaliation for supposed acts of terrorists by its shadowy group known as Hamas. Almost exclusively, Hamas engages in rocket attacks against Israel. More specifically, it has launched tens of thousands of rockets against Israel over a span of decades. And get a load of this. these rockets have never hurt anyone or even hit any targets. All this information can be gleaned from our history books and or newspapers. However, for these, for those looking for a more concise reference source, just jump on the internet. Obviously, if these rocket attacks were being perpetrated by blind people, as a matter of statistics, at least occasionally the rockets would hit something and kill someone through sheer luck. Thus, as a proposition of elementary logic, the only way in which tens of thousands of rockets could never hit anyone anywhere was if they were all deliberate misses. Hamas is not the enemy of Israel, but rather its employee. There is no other logical possibility. This is scary. If there is any other legitimacy to the war on terror, the first nation which should have been in the crosshairs of the U.S. war machine is Israel. The real agenda to this police state is not to fight terrorism, but to create it and to use it for a pretext for this nonsensical fascist bullshit, following the footsteps of Israel. To illustrate this requires nothing more than pointing to the newest terrorist on the block, ISIS or ISIL. And there's a U.S. Lieutenant General running around called Tom McKerney, who is actually quoting this, saying, "We helped to build ISIS." But the general is being far too modest. And there's video representations on this on the web. Not only did the U.S. build ISIS by arming and funding it in a step-by-step manner, but this terror-building operation is part of a standard blueprint for American foreign policy. This is one of these videos again. You build up a dictator or extremist group, which can be then used to wage proxy war against opponents. And during this stage, any crimes committed by these proxies are swept under the rug, which is a problem. When these nasty characters have outlived their usefulness, that's when it's time to pull out all the dirt from under the rug and start publicizing it 24/7. This obviously works best when the public has no idea how these bad guys came to power. The U.S. sponsored them. Finally, when the public is practically begging for the government to do something, a solution is proposed. Usually the solution involves military intervention, the loss of certain liberties, or both. There's the solution. Sound familiar? We just saw precisely the strategy being played out in Afghanistan in a campaign spanning nearly 30 years. When the U.S. was building up an extremist group in Afghanistan as its beloved allies to fight the Soviets, the world knew these extremists by the name Mujahideen. When the U.S. government wished to move to stage two and demonize these same extremists, they rebranded them and named them Al-Qaeda. And then when it wanted to move to stage three, starting a war and stripping Americans of their civil liberties, it lured or simply hired these same thugs to be part of the world's most infamous false flag event. Good old 9/11. Unequivocally, the war on terror is nothing more than an imaginary construct of this Fourth Reich. Any and all terrorists who actually do exist in the world today were either created or sponsored by the U.S. government or the other members of this ridiculous axis of evil, which is comprised of money. However, the police state, which was supposedly justified by this mythical war, is all too real. The Department of Homeland Security is nothing more than the Nazi Gestapo. The only difference between the two agencies is that the DHS is much better armed and has the advantage of 21st century saturation surveillance, the ability and willingness to spy on anyone at any time. This is the Edward Snowdens of the world. This is what's the guy who did WikiLeaks? I mean, the transformation of the U.S. from free democracy to police state only became full and complete when the Bush regime passed its infamous infinite detention law in 2011. Everybody thinks George Bush was bad. He did this stuff overtly. Obama is every bit as bad, if not worse. There's more military actions going on the planet now by a huge number, 50% more now that Obama is in power than when Bush was in power. Suggests for a moment, perhaps, that the presidents do not run things. So Bush imposed this infinite detention law in 2011, given the already existing provisions of the Patriot Act, which blew holes through the U.S. Constitution. Indefinite detention turned that Constitution into nonsense. The legalities here, given the indefinite detention, is the U.S. government, or one of its stooges, points its finger at anyone and calls them a terrorist. Once any individual has that label affixed to them, they immediately and instantly lose not only all of their constitutional rights, but all of their human rights. They become less than human in the eyes of this police state, and the U.S. government is never required to publicly produce evidence to provide that someone accused of being terrorist has done anything to merit this ultimate sanction. So they become guilty until proven innocent. Once the U.S. government demotes someone to a legal subhuman by labeling them as a terrorist, not only does this Fourth Reich incarcerate and torture them, but the executive branch now claims the power to murder by decree, again, without ever publicly providing evidence to support these assassinations. Here, it must be understood that if people, i.e. Americans, can be stripped of their rights simply by having the label terrorist affixed to them, without evidence, then they have no rights. By definition, a right is something that can never be taken away. In the former U.S., now a police state, which can be characterized as nothing other than the 1% accumulating all their powers to subdue and subordinate the citizens that they should be answering to. Now all the rights of these citizens, of this U.S. of A., they used to possess are now mere privileges, something which can be taken away from any one of them completely and forever with one word. Always without evidence. Okay. While this one reality encapsulates this police state in a comprehensive manner, no one epitomizes it more than the way the Americans are arming its schools with M16 rifles and grenade launchers. Tear gas, armored trucks, and Rikers. I mean, the police of the states right now are getting militarized. Who is taking custody of the surplus military weaponry? School police departments. Why do schools even need their own police departments? They don't, except in police states. Here it must be noted that every single U.S. school director is already within the jurisdiction of a city or a municipality that has a police force. What is it going on? Oh, they're giving them their surplus will of military weaponry. Now, here in Canada, one of the U.S.'s closest allies, but yet to become a police state, what did the Canadians do with their own surplus military gear? After 12 years of military operations, more than 95% of it was put in museums. So when will the Americans have their rights restored? When will this 1% give back? When the war on terror is over. When is the war on terror over? Given that they've manufactured the terrorists and the terrorism, never. Now, while this infrastructure and pseudo-laws of this police state are designed to last forever, the economy which provides the financial support for them is already completely and utterly rotten to the core. The only thing that has delayed a Soviet Union-style economic implosion to this date is financial fraud and the manipulation of markets on a scale beyond the comprehension of anybody who has not been closely following these events. The detention centers, police states, prisons are all built. Complete economic collapse is inevitable and imminent. And when that occurs, that's when we start to fall into martial law. So now I want to bring you back to the other side of this equation, and I want to talk about this little African group of children who said, how could we have these fruits when everybody else would not have them? Greed has run amok. As go we, so go I. They do not get and understand, and this is the normal course of evolution. It is a normal course of learning from this nonsense, that which does not serve us. there is a cosmic law called the law of cause and effect, and the Buddhists would make reference to this as the law of karma. Now, the law of karma, or the law of cause and effect, is that you reap that which you sow. They have dug themselves a hole that is imminently going to destroy them. How best do we respond to this? How best do we prepare ourselves for this? Well, we are watching a slow-moving train wreck, and we are watching a hijacking of the U.S. democratic system. Now, we talk about in the ancient schools, or the ancient mystery schools, or the ancient teachings, we talk about not that we should be living in this world less, but we should be in both worlds more. We should be getting calm and quiet and listening to that inner voice of how best to organize our lives in a fashion where we cannot be compromised by the government's agenda. We need to wake up to the fact that the U.S. government and the money behind any government whose agenda is concentrating their wealth at the expense of everybody else, their agenda is not in alignment with the vast majority of people. They are paying off those decision makers with the money they're printing ad nauseum. They are in an economic circling the drain, if you will. And they are preparing for the collapse of the system. Now, the collapse of the system may begat a one-world currency. And a one-world currency disempowers and impoverishes most of the planet. And they're going to do it with military force, and they're going to do it in an evolution of martial law. What a nightmare. What a nightmare. Now, how do we next play this hand? Can we next play this hand by doing this? Let us prepare for this. Let us extricate or get out of the system, as our friend Jim Sinclair is wont to say. Let's get ourselves out of the system in a place where the governments, if they should, go in and choose to steal your money. You don't have much money in the bank that they can steal. Let us choose to be able to see these things through eyes unclouded by propaganda. It's an important place to stand. As go we, so go I. Be ever mindful that what you're being told on mainstream media is desperately, desperately incomplete. It is used to manipulate. It is used to create mindsets and memes that are dangerous to the welfare of the planet. What good is all this wealth for this 1%? It's not very flipping good when the economy disappears. But let me tell you, that wealth buys an enormous amount of control. And again, these wealthy individuals are not quarter of annual year players anymore. They are decades or dozens of decades players. Let us accumulate all of the wealth of the planet. And they've done it. The 1% wealthy on the planet control it absolutely unequivocally. Okay, how do we best organize ourselves? Get out of the system. If you have RRSPs, I suspect that it might be time to leave. The markets have never been loftier. I would suspect that it's a bubble. I've also seen the price of gold drop precipitously. Again, this is part of the manipulation of economics to facilitate an image that everything is okay. It is not okay. Individuals far more clever than I are rapidly buying up as much gold as they possibly can. Let us not lose sight of it. Let us not lose sight of this direction. I bid you to not lose sight of this direction, and I bid you to recognize that this time is a very important time. And it's a time that we need to take heed of. It's a time that we need to take stock of what's really happening. It's a time to get quiet enough and understand that things are not as they seem. Please. 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 And with that, ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday, October 3rd, 2014, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. Thank you for allowing us to be of service. See you next week. Thank you.